The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bazong.
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 Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong.
This is Bazong, the Bizarre and Weird Fiction Podcast, with me, your host, Mr. Frank Zongers. Thanks for joining us again this week, as you always do, dedicatedly so. I appreciate each and every one of you who tune into Bazong as much as you can to check out all the weird and crazy that we bring you week after week here on the Project Entertainment Network. Zongers, of course, the only way we can bring Bazong to you each week, every week on the Project Entertainment Network is to support the sponsors who support the Project Entertainment Network. And I, of course, am talking about none other than Subculture Corsets and Clothing. You can find them on the web at subculturecorsets.com. They have rockabilly, steampunk, pan up, goth. I said rockabilly, right? They got all these cool freaking clothes, shoes, and accessories as well. They have books and toys, all kinds of fantastic stuff for your sexy needs. You know what I'm saying? They have the corsets. If you want to look cool this con season, you're going to have to shop at Subculture Corsets and check out all the fantastic standout clothing they have for you to show up to see and be seen in. As you know, Zongers, I've been kind of spotlighting some of the clothing I'm enjoying on Subculture Courses. Last few weeks, I've been checking out the oh-so-sexy female clothing. But this week, I keep mentioning it, and I had to take a look. They have the kilts, Zongers. They do have kilts at Subculture Courses. Just go into the men's section and check out the Outlander kilt. That is some bad-ass gothic punk Celt pride shit. If you're going to show up looking like a badass at a con this year, like a horror con or like maybe a punk con or just a punk rock flea market, something you want to be a little extra badass in, you're going to want to check out the Outlander kilt from subculturecorsetsandclothing.com on the web at subculturecorsets.com. And if you want to save 10% off the Outlander kilt, all you do is put in the promotional code at checkout, Bazong, and you will receive 10% off your kilt. But as I always say, Zongers, buy more and save more. That 10% off does not apply to one item, and it applies to your entire order. So if you want to get some cool, like, overcoat with that or a tie or some freaking kick-ass boots, add them on there. You'll save 10% off your entire order with the promotional code Bazong at checkout at subculturecorsets.com. Or if you're in the Jacksonville, Florida area, you can go check out their store, their flagship store at the Avenues Mall in Jacksonville, Florida. And I am told there will be expansion of stores. They're going to start spreading out across the malls and retail places of America. So, you know, for now, if you're not close, shop Subculture. So for now, if you're not close, just shop at subculturecorsets.com. And if you are close, go check them out at the Avenues Mall in Jacksonville, Florida. Oi, 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 Zongers. That's right. This week, we're taking it punk style over to England. I keep traveling overseas, and I don't mind because there are some fantastic bizarro and weird fiction writers I am discovering across the pond and in places afar. And this week, man, he's been in the game for so long, and he kind of fell off of my radar, and I don't know why. And recently, our guest this week, I was shopping around a book that will be out in May. I'm just going to go ahead and release it myself because J. David Osborne said so. But as I was shopping around this book, I came across a publisher called Crowded Quarantine over in England. And come to find out, Crowded Quarantine is run by none other than Adam Millard. And if that doesn't just send tingles rushing up your spine and you don't know who Adam Millard is, He came on my bizarro radar when he released a book called Hamster Damned with Strange House Books a few years back. And then he's also released a book called Tsunami through Rooster Republic. He's Vinyl Destination from Rooster Republic. He's in Tall Tales with Short Cocks. He's in Strange vs. Lovecraft. And he just does, you know, he's by and large, like a horror guy, a splatterpunk guy, but he does a lot of smattering of bizarro stuff because, you know, when you do splatterpunk horror, stuff like that, you're going to trip and fall into bizarro. It just happens that way. It just, you bring the weird on when you do that. He has a really good series called the Larry series. That's like this serial killer splatterpunk thing. Also fantastic stuff. So I discovered Adam while I was shopping my book around. And I had every intention. I'm like, oh, my God, Adam Millard. I totally got to have him on. I didn't want to have him on while I was shopping my book with him. So I had to push him off a little bit. So we finally, we're past the point where he said, fuck you and your book. I don't want it. And no hard feelings. I know how it goes. It's not the proper fit for him. And I get it. But I still love the guy. And I have to have him on the podcast. So let some time there. So I didn't look like a douchebag. And now I have invited him on the show. And he's just a fantastic, wonderful gentleman who is very gracious and has, you know, you want my opinion? He has the best look in Bizarro. There it is. I said it. He has the best look in Bizarro. He's got the mohawk with like a stylish, he's like punk on top and business on the bottom. He is awesome. Without further ado, Zongers, Mr. Adam Millard. Give us the gong. I'd like to welcome to Bazong this week a writer. Oh my God, to say he's prolific would be an understatement. The man is the author of 22 novels, 13 novellas, and he's written over 200 short stories. And there's a lot of bizarro sprinkled in on all that stuff. So I'd like to welcome to Bazong this week none other than Adam Millard. Adam, welcome to Bazong.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Frank.
It's a pleasure and an honor. My God, you know, I know you did a lot of work, but to see those numbers and to look up your books and your whole catalog, my God, over 20, you got 22 novels, 13 novellas, and 200 short stories. Is that all you do all day long is write?
Yeah, it's pretty much all I do. I tend to work until I hit about 4,000 words and then go back to being sort of a family man. So it's works, you know, I'm quite disciplined. I'm fortunate to be able to do it as well full time. So yeah, it's my thing.
Now 4,000 words a day, that's sort of roughly your daily goal, 4,000 words. How easy does that come to you? How long does that take you generally?
Some days, you know, I can just breeze through it and it's nice, and then other days it will take 6 or 7 hours. But I tend to try and hit at least 4,000 words a day. There are days when I'll carry on until I hit 6 or 7, but it's rare. It's even rarer now. So my wife's just given birth to our second child, so it's a case of doing what I can do now.
Yeah. That's kind of things get put on hold because the smaller they are, the less they care about your time.
Yeah, I'm stopping. I'm picking the baby up. I'm feeding it. I'm doing all this adult shit.
Yeah,
it's slowed me down a little bit, but I'm still working.
That's the important thing, to keep going through.
Yeah, there have been times, there have been days where, you know, I've done nothing, especially the last couple of weeks. But I feel guilty, sort of angry with myself for not doing anything. I think self-imposed, you know, deadlines and self-imposed word counts and things, and it just gets to you a little bit. So it's quite important that I actually get something down on the page, even if it's, you know, a bit of flash fiction or something.
Right, just always write something.
Just something, yeah. I always feel better. Once I've done it, I'm in a much better mood. It's really weird. I think most writers are the same. It's like that self, you know, that bit of guilt that, you know, you're slacking, or, you know, it's not as if I've got no ideas. It's a case of, yeah, I've just not got the time today, or mm-hmm. I'm not in the right mindset, or I had 2 hours sleep, or, you know. But yeah, I think it's important to just sort of push through it and try and get stuff done.
Now, on all this writing you do, on the Bizarro stuff, which obviously we're going to focus on this podcast.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, how did you come to discover Bizarro?
It was a sort of a culmination of things. It was I picked up The Haunted Vagina, which I just picked up because I thought it sounded freaking hilarious. So I picked it up and read it, and I was like, because this is the first I've ever heard of Bizarro. I was like, this is good. And then I realized there's a whole load of others out there. So it's all Carlton's fault, really. So I started reading all that, started doing a bit of research, and found out there were a few presses out there. And it was around that time that Vincenzo Beloff actually sent me an email asking me if I'd submit to
Bizarro Pulp Press.
A novella to Bizarro Pulp Press. Mm-hmm. I think it was Pat was running it at the time. I think just before.
Okay.
And so obviously I was like, well, yeah, definitely. I'll try. I'd never written anything like that before. But I just like the sheer fun of writing something, so, you know, like take the shackles off kind of thing, you mm-hmm. know, sit and see what happens. So I ended up writing Skinners for Bizarro Pulp Press, and then I think it was just called Bizarro Press at the time. And then I got asked to write a short story for Tall Tales for Shawcox Volume 1, I think it was, mm-hmm. From Rooster Republic. And I was like, yeah, this is actually a thing, you know, this is quite a big thing. I'm gonna try and get into this. So that was it, really. And since then I've been trying to write as much as possible. I just like the people, the you know, the genre, the whole thing. It's like it was made for me, you know what I mean? So yeah, that's pretty much how I came across Bizarro.
So would you say your writing maybe always had a bit of Bizarro to it, or really it was reading The Haunted Vagina that kind of awoke that need in you to write something that's so wacky and zany and untethered?
Yeah, it was. See, I mean, I've always written sort of humorously anyway. It's like I tend to, you know, throw jokes in or little running gags or things, and which I didn't realize I was doing, but it's sort of the way I've always done it. I've written serious stuff and serious horror stuff, and at the time, I mean, I was writing pure zombies. It was just before zombies became everything. So I had a sort of zombie series that was completely serious, completely straight, and, you know, and then just grew sick and tired of zombies and decided to write other things. But yeah, the humorous element, which is, you know, which pretty much sort of goes through most of my work now, has kind of always been there.
I see. So I'm looking here at your Bizarro work. We'll put that in quotes, Bizarro work, because sometimes it's hard to stamp on what is bizarre and what isn't. But directly,
yeah, exactly. I mean, I
go ahead.
Some of the stuff I write, yeah, I wouldn't even consider as bizarre. I'd consider it more comedy horror. But you know, there's definitely sort of elements of Bizarro in some of it. Yeah.
You seem to almost have a period of heavy Bizarro work. Is that how you kind of see it? Like you had Hamster Damned and Vinyl yeah. Destination. You went through this sort of heavy Bizarro period. Is it just the way things worked out, or were you like, is that really where you were like, oh, look, I can do this, and this is so much fun, and like getting it out of your system?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I needed to get it out. I think Hamster Damned and Vinyl Destination were written pretty close together. I can't remember, but I think in between I was writing straight sort of horror as well. It was like I'd write a bizarro book and then move on to a couple of short stories or things to submit to anthologies that I'd been invited to, and they'd just be straight horror. And then once I've written the straight horror, I was desperate to get back into writing bizarro and the more humorous things, because it's kind of like a relief. I quite enjoy getting back into, right, this is, for some reason, I write it easier than the straight stuff. I find it easier to write. There's a lot less, obviously a lot less research, a lot less constraint. It's all sort of, it's just built up there, so it's like it just comes flowing out. And it's always nice to do that after I've written something serious. I don't know what it is.
I kind of envy you because you do write this. I'm similar to you in my writing. Is it always comes out as like comedy horror essentially?
Yeah.
And I try to write straight things. I can't. It's all, something stupid's gonna just wind up in there. And so I really identify what you're writing. When I first saw you, it was when you put out Hamsterdam with Strange House Books. So, like, you know, my impression of you is like you're this bizarro guy. Like, that's where you came from. And I saw like that little period where you're putting out a lot of bizarro work. And I really didn't realize you were doing other like really straight horror stuff until like a couple of years later. And I'm like, oh, wow, this guy's like all over the place. And holy mackerel.
In a way, I think I've sort of made a mistake. It's like, because everything's under the same name, you'll get the people who enjoy the bizarro stuff will read the more serious stuff and not like it as much, and vice versa. And it's, I've spoken to people and they said sort of maybe you should use a pen name for one or the other. And I don't know, I think it's a bit late for that now. I mean, I've even written children's stories under the same name. Mm-hmm. You know, Peter Crombie, Teenage Zombie, and those books were written under the same name that wrote The Human Centipede. So it's you know, it all comes up under the same search.
Yeah.
Should have thought in hindsight.
Yeah, but it's I don't know. I think nowadays it seems like there's a lot of writers that are, you know, they're spreading their wings. They're moving out into different genres and keeping their stamp, their brand on it. If you can call it a brand when you're switching gears, going from like literary horror over to some kind of weird Western stuff. So I don't know. It might be a jolt for casual readers, but I think in the indie markets where everything is sort of niche, like you have a tight group of readers. And I think at the very least, they would understand, if not appreciate, your stretching out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the good thing. I mean, I do a lot of conventions and signings over here, and it's you will get people coming up to the table and they'll pick up, right, I haven't got that one. I've read all of those, but I haven't got these ones. And they'll pick up the straight horror and the bizarro, the weird shit, regardless. So it's I must be doing something right.
Agreed. And now you mentioned getting out there doing the thing. You are... you also run Crowded Quarantine Press. How long has that been around?
It was founded in 2011, I believe. So 6 years now. And we've put out about, I don't know, close to 30 books. Within our limits, we don't like to take on too much at the same time. You know, right. We've seen presses have gone under for doing silly things, mm-hmm. and being, you know, overly enthusiastic. So we've sort of kept it small. We got 3 books coming out this year, and possibly 2 more next year. But yeah, we like to keep it small and put out decent books and decent products. So got some limited editions as well, which are always signed and numbered or signed and lettered. So they're always fun to put together. And yeah, it's been going for a while. I mean, we've seen presses, you know, come and then implode, and it's quite affirming to know that we're still going strong after 6 years, which, you know, there's a lot of competition out there now. A lot of people doing it, a lot of people thinking they can do it and not realizing actually you need to put money into this. You need to, you know, you need to get editors, you need to pay designers, you need to put some money behind it. And I think, you know, we're just happy that, you know, we've sort of made our mark. We've kept it small, but we were, one of our authors were was nominated for a British Fantasy Award last year, so one of our books didn't win, but it was up against Adam Neville.
it's so, tough competition.
So we weren't too upset about losing to Adam Neville.
Yeah. It seems like I just discover you over long stretches of time, like I said, with the bizarre thing to realize you have all this horror. The same thing for Crowder Quarantine. I just realized last year you had an open submission call I was shopping something around and I'm like, oh, what's this quarantine? And as soon as I saw you were the guy, that I'm like, oh, for this is legit, you know. So I submitted to it, but I'm like, oh my God, this has been around for, how do I not know about Crowded Quarantine? And you've got
one of those that's just like under the radar, uh-huh. But unless you sort of know about it. But we try and put ourselves out. We had an open submission. We'll probably have another one next year. Providing, you know, everything's still going strong and
right.
You know, I don't run out of money.
you definitely curate very good books for sure. And the names, yeah. I mean, I know the people you publish. It's like, how did they fly by me? But you publish a lot of your own stuff too under Crowded Quarantine, right?
Yeah, but you know, I don't promote my own stuff when I release it under, you know, I will sort of go out my way to promote like Chris Kelso and Rich Hawkins, but a lot of sort of my books I'll just release and I won't say, oh, it's from Crowded Quarantine, because you know, if you're using a press to sort of build up your own portfolio, it feels a bit roguish. I know it's probably not. I mean, there's a lot of people that do it, but I sort of just put books out and just maybe share it once or twice under you know me. That's why, I mean, a lot of my books aren't available on the Crowded website. Mm-hmm. They're available from my own website, my own personal website, but I feel like I should be promoting our authors rather than myself. I'd rather concentrate on the good stuff that people are submitting and you know, try and keep it separate. When we first started out, I mean, it was an idea just to have a name to release my own stuff and maybe an anthology here or there, but then we started building up a list of authors, and it was a case of, okay, you can carry on releasing, but you know, I tend not to release everything now through myself. I've been lucky enough to submit and get accepted elsewhere, but some of the stuff that I know is not going to sell, I will tend to, I mean, sell to other publishers. I know it'll sell, but yeah. Sell to other publishers. I will still just slip in, see what happens.
Well, I mean, that's a completely respectable approach. I guess that's, you know, more to display to the your authors that you have or potential authors. Yeah. Like, this is not about me, you know.
It's kind of to. I think I've read some articles and I do agree in a way. It's it would be a kind of a red flag if you were searching for a publisher and most of their books were from the owner of the publisher. It would be kind of off-putting to submit. And I didn't want to do that, so it was I want people to send in their stuff and know that we're gonna, you know, do good things. So
and it begs the question, you have a really good operation there, but you do all this writing. Where do you even find time to curate a publishing house?
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a case of just time management. once my own writing's done, I tend to get up early and get my own stuff out of the way, and then also and then move on to editing novels for our authors, or designing, because I do a lot of the design work for the covers, and put those together, format, do all the formatting, the PDFs, the MOBIs, and the, you know, it's basically, it is a one man show, but it's something that I really enjoy doing as well. And also trying to, I don't know, arrange book launches and things. I quite enjoy doing, phoning around hotels, seeing if I can get a cheap room somewhere. Can we put some books out? That kind of thing. So it's all about time management. I mean, there's plenty of hours in the day. I think I'm just lucky that I get to do it as a job. And if I ever had to do real work again, I wouldn't be able to achieve half as much. I also edit freelance as well for various people, so and do a lot of freelance work, editing and copywriting, transcription, that kind of thing. So it's always busy.
Now, see, obviously you're in England, and I don't understand what the scene is there. So how do you get out to like conventions and stuff? Is that how you get out and market your books?
Yeah, I mean, I tend not to leave the house other than conventions. I'm quite a hermit. I will stay in for weeks and weeks, and then I'll have two conventions in a row, and that it's kind of like the only time I'll go out is to get to these conventions to sort of sit behind a table for 12 hours. But yeah, no, the scene's getting quite good now. I mean, there's plenty of horror conventions. Bizarro conventions, there's still nothing at the moment. I have thought about trying to rally the troops over this side and see what we can put together. But horror conventions and that are doing quite well at the moment, and it's with the Bizarro stuff, it's quite easy to slip in between, you know, Adam Neville and David Moody and just sit there and people will buy the Bizarro stuff because it's strange, or it's new, or it's, you know, you'll get, I don't know, people, I think they go sort of hand in hand. It's mm-hmm. The same sort of people would enjoy Bizarro are already into horror or into weird movies or weird fiction. So yeah, I just like that to be a straight Bizarro convention in the UK, which, like I say, if I have my way,
you'll make it happen. Yeah, it feels like it's happening. I'm seeing more and more Bizarro writers coming from Europe and other places outside of, you know, Portland and the United States. So it seems like it's growing pretty good.
Yeah, it's definitely doing something. it's spreading like the Zika virus. I'll try and keep it going over. I know there's a few in Australia now as well, I think.
Yeah.
Can't remember the names, but yeah, it's building. But it's obviously the epicenter is still Portland, and it's always going to be Portland, and I think that's fine. But yeah, we'll see what we can do on our side of the pond.
Well, I can see where being at horror conventions and especially your brand of Bizarro, it has that horror bend to it, of course. So it's probably easier to slip a vinyl destination, sell somebody on that, because there's zombies on the cover. And it's just, yeah. I guess when you start pitching it and telling them about what it is, it sounds a little different than horror.
Yeah, well, that's it. People are like, well, I mean, the Human Centipede, it's the cover that always sells it. I mean, Jim Magpalza's covers are renowned for being, you know, brilliantly twisted. And that cover, the amount of books I sell at conventions because of the that cover specifically, is and when I explain the story, then it's like, oh yeah, but the cover. I'm like, yeah, but the story. and it's a true story.
Of course.
Yeah.
I imagine The Human Centipede is the kind of Christmas book that will sell in July.
It does actually sell all year round, but every single year. I mean, I think it's 2014 I wrote it. So, but this year, it again, come November, I'm sort of checking my accounts and things, and it sells ridiculous amounts every year. People are buying it and gifting it to their grannies. It's ridiculous. My wife actually said, you need to write another Christmas one, because I don't know what it is. So I've been toying with writing a Christmas one, but it's one of those that I think we'll just keep selling every Christmas. I think it'll be as popular as Scrooged one day.
One can only hope. Hope it's as popular as The Human Centipede.
That's all we can aspire to is Scrooged.
Or the Christmas Story too. That would be big. The Human Centipede, that got like some pretty heavy viral buzz too on those like Gawker and stuff like that. I guess that's a big pickup.
I was quite impressed. I think it was shared as well by Tom Six, which did it a little, I think, and Dieter Laser, the guy who plays the doctor, he shared it as well. But yeah, I think that helped. And I've seen a thread on Reddit recently. I think it was this Christmas just gone, and people were like, it's just a piece of shit. Have you read it? No, but if there's one book that somebody thought of a title and then wrote a story around a title,
that's the one.
A piece of shit. And I was like, you got a point, really.
Well, you can't have all love. Yeah, there's got to be some hate.
I was surprised that it hadn't been done. So it was. I had to check first that it hadn't been done before I started writing it. So,
yeah.
I was lucky it hadn't been done. But yeah, it's a nice, joyous Christmas tale.
Now you got to look for maybe something for Easter. Spread out that holiday cheer.
Just hit all the holidays. Yeah.
When you're doing well for yourself in England, how difficult it is for you to market back in the U.S. when you're not, you know, right in that market?
I find that the U.S. is actually equal, if not better, than sales in the U.K. I have no idea why. I think it's because we're all over here sitting around, you know, drinking tea and, you know, singing God Save the Queen and shit. And it's over there, it's a lot more, you know, everything's just fucking awesome. It was like when I went to BizarroCon for the first time last year, it was just so much, I don't know. Everything just seemed more fun. I think we are quite uptight. Stiff upper lip and all that. But I think it's true. I think American readers are more likely to pick up a copy of The Human Centipede than British readers, I'd say. Maybe once Bizarro becomes the next... the next big thing over here, then it'll even out, kind of thing. But yeah, I tend to find that I always sell better in America on a monthly basis, which is nice.
I never thought of that sort of ingrained stuffiness of the British culture could work against you.
We're all over here just queuing for no reason, just joining queues to buy tickets to see, fucking, I don't know, Kasabian.
I mean, I got to imagine there's something very Shakespearean about the human centipede that would appeal to all the boys.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Santa's ubiquitous. He's everywhere. He's sort of, he's this, we've got our version, but I think I wrote him sort of with a British sort of accent, even though he's nowhere near. I think it's one of those things. I try not to use Britishisms in my writing anymore. Try and keep it more neutral, because I know that the readers in America have reviewed my things and said, "Oh, this was written by a Brit," or "This was written by a fucking." So I tend to just try and keep it more neutral now, so people can make their mind up and say, "Oh, this could be set anywhere," kind of thing. Unless I'm setting it in a specific place or a specific town in England, then obviously it's very English, and I'll throw in the slang and the, you know, the phrases that we tend to use.
Yeah,
more often. Yeah.
So interesting that to hear that you have to sort of be aware of keeping those things out of your work, because I've seen it myself where I have friends reading books and they're like, fucking using the color word, and so this fucking British. I'm like, who cares? It's just, you know it's color and it still means the same shit. But people kind of lose their shit sometimes over that. It's really odd.
I've had reviews that have specifically pointed out the fact that I'm from the UK, even though I've set the story, say, in America. And they will say, "This guy's not funny. How dare he write about America? He's not from America." So it's one of those things now that I'm sort of aware of. And I try and tread a bit more carefully, because I don't want to piss off anybody.
I'm sure there's no British people reading American books going, "Oh, this guy, he wrote color without the U. With this bullshit."
This guy says aluminum. Aluminum.
Aluminum.
Yeah. Aluminum.
Yeah. Fucking Yank.
Fucking aluminum. How dare it. Yeah. We invent the language.
Yeah. Yeah, we did it first. It's called English. Yeah, that's so crazy. Do you, you mentioned too that you wrote the Santa with, like, you know, a British accent. Is that in your head when you're writing inflections and accents too?
I think it's just sort of the terms or the phrases that people say, the things that people say. Coming from England, we have a lot of, you know, silly sayings that wouldn't be used in America. When I went to BizarroCon last year and I said that I ate faggots for dinner, that just caused an uproar. That was crazy. We eat faggots nearly every week, which is, and then everyone was like, "You eat what?" I'm like, "Faggots, you know, like Scotch eggs, you know." But I tend to write still under my own voice, but trying to, you find yourself, I delete a lot more than I actually write, especially with the straight horror stuff, because I'll be putting jokes in and then I'll have to remove them because I think, no, you're not doing that. That's not what this book is. This book's serious, you know. So I will take out more than actually put in, which is, you know, not conducive to being a writer.
Well, I mean, it's part of the process too. Cleaning up that work and taking out what doesn't fit. I mean, how much time do you spend editing your stuff as opposed to handing it over to an editor, you know?
I usually, once I've finished a book, I will leave it for a month and then go back to it and work through it at least two or three times. And then my wife occasionally will read to see if I've missed anything, but she tends not to get herself involved.
Yeah.
Especially if it's something really, you know, really bizarre. The favorite her favorite books that I've written are for children, which says a lot about her, really, more so than me.
I
tend to edit quite intensely for you know, two or three drafts at least. But you're always going to miss something.
Ooh. Oh yeah, I do the same thing where I got to put it down for a while, because if I try to analyze it right away, I just think the worst of it. I don't think I'm like, oh, this is garbage. I can't believe. And so I put it away, like you said, for a good month. Give it some time. Let me forget that I wrote this. And then I'll pick it up and go, oh my God, who wrote this? Is fucking brilliant. Oh, I wrote this. Awesome. But
that's it.
But it's
whenever I'm reading something, like, because I do readings and things as well. And it's like, if I'm reading a bizarro story or something for the first time in a while, I will think, actually, you know what? This is quite funny, and the audience is laughing, and I'm sort of, and then the audience is cringing, and I'm like, oh fucking yes, this is perfect. but yeah, I think leaving it does give you that time, because I'm thinking it's shit as I'm writing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm sort of, yeah, this is just nonsense. But by the time you go back to it, it's fresh, it's nice, it's actually decent. And I think it's important. I couldn't just finish a book and start editing it straight away, because it would drive me insane.
Yeah, and plus, just edit for me. I just hate even editing, because I don't reread anybody else's work, so I'm definitely not going to reread my own stuff. But oh my God, so it's punishing for me to like go over and over again and just give this to an editor. Let them deal with it, please.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, you know, give this to somebody who hasn't fucking read it already. Yeah, but I think that's why I'm a bit of a sado in as much as editing for other people as well, and editing for Crowded Quarantine, editing for freelance clients as well. It's I enjoy editing other people's stuff more so than my own. Because I will sort of read it more closely, and whereas your own stuff, you've written it, you think you skip through it more so.
Yeah,
I think that's why mistakes still manage to creep in. You do need, if I could afford an editor for every book I wrote, I would.
Yeah,
I think that's. But then I'd never have any money, so.
Yeah, you're a writer after all. There's only so much money.
There's only so much.
Now we gotta talk about your look, because your look is awesome. You're out there at a convention. I walk by your table and I see you. I'm gonna be a little apprehensive about coming up to you, because I think you may want to strangle me. what's the look? Is this just your thing? You've always done this thing. You know, what's it all about?
I call it Wolverhampton eccentric. It's sort of like hobo chic. it's a weird combination of punk and waistcoat, usually. I've always had, for the last 7 or 8 years, I've had the mohawk and the piercings, the tattoos. Obviously, I've been there for a while. But yeah, I think there's something. I do enjoy dressing up and wearing a waistcoat and things. So I think it's a good look. I don't know. I might be wrong. Everybody's going, look at this.
It's a great look for a writer, because, you know, like I said, you got that weird, like, oh, this guy might punch me look. But then you got, you know, you're all proper from the neck down. So it's like, well, oh, okay.
I think he's right. I'm as nice as anything. You know, people always, you know, come up to my table and talk to me. I'm you know, an amiable chap. I got approached by a school about 4 or 5 years ago. To come in and do some creative writing with the year sevens, which is like 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds. And because of the look, because of, you know, he doesn't look like a regular you know, what you would expect a writer to look like, or, you know, he doesn't look, I don't know what that would be, by the way, but, so they got me in on the premise that I looked suitably different and that the children might relate to, actually, this guy's, you know, he's okay. So, and I've been invited back every year since. I go every May or June. I travel across the country and teach year seven kids creative writing for a couple of days.
So, oh, wow.
And that's all based on the fact that I spiked my hair.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I've got tattoos on my necks and hands. Necks. I have plural necks.
So yeah, it's kind of refreshing that, you know, it wasn't a situation where, like, you're gonna have to cover up all your tattoos and put on a cap and.
No, it was they expect me to turn up with, you know, metal hanging out my face, uh-huh, and my tattoos sort of on show, and green or purple hair. It's just one of those things. It's, and to me, I mean, you know, my son wouldn't recognize me if I was anything different now, because I have he's almost six now, but he's always, this is all he's ever known is, mm-hmm, is me looking like I should be in the Warriors.
Now, did you specifically craft that look because you didn't want to have to work a real job for the rest of your life, and that was like a sure bet?
That's my point. It was like, yeah, because there's no going back now.
No,
it's like, you know, I've got ink pretty much everywhere that I could have ink. Uh-huh. And yeah, I know for a fact that if I had to go and interview for a real job, they wouldn't have me, so I would have to just carry on writing forever.
Yeah. That's a good,
I think,
plan.
It's a sensible thing to do.
That is a good plan.
So yeah, but I have no tattoos on my face, so I suppose I could always be a beekeeper or something.
That might work. Anything where you have to be, you could be like a nuclear engineer and put on the big thermal suit and stuff like that.
Yeah, these kind of jobs that I could do.
Maybe nuclear, an astronaut.
Or astronaut, yeah.
Yeah, it could be one of them too. Anything you have to cover up. But I like anything. You just fine as a writer.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to stop doing one.
Good stuff. Has the look ever worked counter to you, or just because of, you know, the writing thing, and it hasn't been that situation?
No, I mean, it's been pretty, you know, I can look how I want to look and do what I want to do. The handlebar moustache has come back now. After a few months off, the year before, I had to shave the handlebar moustache off because I had to wear prosthetics for a short film, and so they made me shave off my moustache.
Wow.
Which I was it was for prosthetic reasons. They were like, this is gonna hurt, it's gonna stick, you'd be better off just taking it off. So I did for my art. Mm-hmm. But it's back now, so yeah, I think I'm gonna keep it for a while. I think that adds a little extra style to the face. You don't see many handlebar moustaches.
No, I was going to say, it keeps you very unique, and it kind of blends your punk look on top with your very proper look down the bottom. It's a good blending
point. Yeah, well, that's it. It's like, but also, I mean, it's not like a gimmick or anything. It's just how I feel comfortable.
Right.
I'm quite comfortable in my own skin. Probably for the first time, you know, I was quite awkward in my 20s. Uh-huh. I had long black hair. I went through a Marilyn Manson phase. It was not good for anybody. So I sort of just evolved, and I'm relatively at peace with myself for the first time, which
that's
is good.
Awesome. That's awesome. So you wish you would have come to the mohawk and the piercings and tattoos much earlier.
Much earlier, yeah. I growing up, I mean, I was 17, 18, and then I went in the army. So I came out of the army, and I was sort of had a a marine haircut, and you know, and it took me a while to figure out where I needed to be. So yeah, this is good now.
I'm happy to hear it. It's an awesome look, and it keeps you, you know, unique and standing out where you have to stand out in a sea of a bazillion riders, right?
Yeah.
Adam, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time together. I want to just maybe touch on what you got coming out, and maybe any more bizarre work coming out, or just work in general.
I believe there's an anthology coming out shortly called More Bizarro Than Bizarro.
Yeah.
Which I have a story in called Die High Private Eye.
Wonderful.
Which is pretty much what it says on the tin. It's about a private investigator who gets shot whilst high on coke and then has to try and find his killer whilst also dealing with the fact that he's fucked. So that's coming out in that anthology.
Been looking forward to that one.
Bizarro Pulp Press and Journal Stone. And I have Swimming in the Sea of Trees coming out from Dark Fuse, which is a serious, very sort of dark ghost story set in the Japanese suicide forest.
Mm-hmm.
Not funny at all. But, you know, I was quite pleased with it. So, I was thrilled when they offered to publish it. So that was good. And I'm currently just writing short stories. So if anybody's got any anthologies open, I'm having a year of short stories this year. Mm-hmm. Because I figure I can fit those in around this new child thing that's popped out.
Yeah, I can see where you'd have to click back to the shorter work.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, right, I can concentrate on, you know, a short story rather than get involved. And we'll see where we go from there. But yeah, now I've got three novels that have been finished and are currently with agents or publishers. So we'll see. But yeah, keeping busy.
Good deal. And I'd like to point out, you just had a third Larry book, which they're great. It's like you're keeping Splatterpunk alive. And it got a little, you know, we could call that bizarre. It's a good little transition book.
Yeah. I'd say it's not quite bizarre, but it's a good place if you like horror comedy. And
yeah,
Larry 3D is recently released and features obviously Pigface and Willem Dafoe, and there's David Bowie's in there as well.
Right, you're going to tell me Willem Dafoe and Pigface and it's not a bizarre book.
Yeah.
Of course, exactly. It's got a touch of bizarre. I love Larry's awesome, fun reading. And gory too. It's fun.
But yeah, there will be a Larry 4 at some point if enough people pester me to get it done.
All right, I'll be sure to pester you then.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes.
Very sweet. Adam Millard, I want to thank you for coming on, spending time with us on Bizong this week. Best of luck to you with my
thank
you got
you
so much going on, and I mean, you got the kids, so extra good luck to you. I know how that goes.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Mr. Adam Millard, Zongers. I can't even begin to tell you where you should check out Adam Millard. He does have so much stuff out there to read. Of course, check out his bizarre work, Hamster Damned or Tsunami or Vinyl Destination. Those are great places to start. If you have any of the Tall Tales or Short Cox books, you can find them in some of those. And, you know, if you want to look at his more splatterpunky horror stuff, check out the Larry series. That's a lot of fun, fantastic gore, if you ask me, Zongers. And you must be, because you're here. So, Zongers, don't forget, Bizong and the Project Entertainment Network do maintain a Patreon campaign page where for as little as $1 a month, you can contribute and receive not only Bizong rewards, but rewards for all the podcasts and the whole network. For instance, I do a monthly Bizarro Book Spotlight video that the new one will be coming out today, as a matter of fact, if you're listening on Monday, February's Bizarro Book Spotlight releases on patreon.com for just a dollar a month. And not only do you get my monthly video Bizarro book spotlight, but you get access to all the other videos and little stories and all that stuff that all the hosts of most of the network is putting up there and sharing. Everybody's adding value to our Patreon campaign. And for you bump up to like $3 a month, you can win show notes, not just from Bizong, but from the horror show with Brian Keene and a few of the other shows. But you're going to want to win Bizong show notes, because on my show notes is where I do all those doodles that I share with everybody. So you can win. This is original show notes, not duplications, photocopies. These are my show. I handed my show notes over to Armand Rosamilia, the curator of Project Entertainment Network. If you win these, you get these show notes I use to conduct the interviews with the authors on Bizong. They are original, and you'll get the doodles that I doodle while I'm interviewing is original. I don't have them, though. They are no longer in my possession. You will have a one-of-a-kind Bizong show note doodle that you could win for $3 a month on Patreon. There's also, you know, if you're into something to promote, advertise, there's advertising specials for the network on Patreon. And don't forget, you don't have to commit yourself to like $700 a month. You know, just one $700 a payment for 1 month and you're done. So you can just go in for the dollar a month. That's essentially $12 a year if you just stick around in $1 chunks. Easy, easy, easy. And you get those fun videos and stuff like that. For $3 a month times 12, 36, 9, something, whatever. You could get the show notes and little other swag and so on and so forth. And you don't have to commit to one level. If you want to, like, I got to have show notes, just do the $3 one month, get some Bizong show notes, and then, you know, drop back down to $1. You want to get on the advertising deals, you hop in on the advertising deal for 1 month, and then you drop back down to $1. Don't drop out, Zongers. That's not cool, right? Right. So keep that in mind. Please, something to consider if you enjoy Bizong and the other shows on the Project Entertainment Network. Just a little extra help. Of course, we put this all out for free, so if you can kick in a dollar here and there, that would be freaking awesome. And Bizong, of course, does maintain social media presence on Facebook at facebook.com/BizongPodcast. No, just /Bizong. And then we're on Twitter at Bizong Podcast, where we tweet out all the links to the shows and other fun stuff and all that good, good gravy. And of course, we do share those doodles on Instagram as well. So look for Bizong on Instagram. Zongers, it's been a pleasure, as always, to bring you wonderful, great, fantastic, talented, bizarre writers, weird fiction writers, week after week on Bizong. But our time here this week is done. So you're now free to go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network of podcasts.
Join us each Wednesday on the Mondo Method Podcast, brought to you by Project Entertainment Network. The Mondo Method Podcast features authors Armand Rosamilia and Chuck Buddha as they discuss the writing process from both the veteran and the novice perspectives. Each episode ends with a segment called Marketing Morsels, where expert publicist Erin Sweet Almahari teaches everyone how to promote their work and sell more books. Check us out on the Mondo Method Podcast on Project Entertainment Network.
Every person's story has something to teach us, how others view life, how obstacles are overcome, how joy is felt, how fears are faced, how love is expressed. The Matters of Faith podcast explores individual stories of people's lives and how faith plays a part. It may not be your story, but it may help shape yours.
The Matters of Faith podcast with Jay Wilburn is on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.